Greetings and welcome to Huddle Up. This is a radio show and podcast that showcases critical thinking and complex problem solving. And it is designed to inform, empower, and amaze. Now, all aboard the Throttle Up Express, powered by High Velocity Reason, and I am your host, Captain Kevin, U.S. Navy retired. Now, our tagline for the show is to accelerate beyond the ordinary. So we could say that we are not ordinary thinkers, you and I, but we are different, are out-of-the-box thinkers. Our motto for the show is to employ high-velocity reason to achieve high-octane performance. And in a nutshell, that basically means to stay out of the problem. That's particularly important if we want to achieve success. Now, our mission statement for the show, and this changes a little bit from time to time, but this is a pretty good mission statement, is to provide the audience with a relatively easy yet effective way to strengthen our power of reason through the employment of critical thinking. Now, our website, the is throttleupradio.com. I wanted to say that our audio engineering services is provided by Evergroove Studios. Also, graphics artist and media support is provided by Reflections Printing. And before we close the introduction, I want to say that the show is typically organized into three parts. Part one of Throttle Up is critical thinking, or an ongoing discussion of various aspects of critical thinking and complex problem solving. Part two is our storyboard, and the storyboard is a story of America or a story of Americans, a story of an individual. It could be any kind of story, but it all relates to trying to get arms around this whole thing, which we call critical thinking and complex problem solving. And then part three is our radio essay. Now, our radio essay is typically a little bit more in-depth treatment of the subject. We do not intend for this to be boring. But for those who would like a little bit more info on certain things that we cover in part one and part two, then part three is a way for us to get a little bit further into a subject matter and understand it better. Okay, all aboard the Throttle Up Express. This is a place where all critics and complex problem solvers are welcome with open arms. Back to Throttle Up after that standard introduction. This is a special edition, so we do special editions from time to time because they are worth repeating. And also, you know, it covers what I think is kind of important subjects and things to consider. And the idea behind a special edition is that it has, or at least I think that it probably does, worth repeating, worth considering. Often I will, if I'm particularly interested in a subject, I will also release or review the video twice or review the audio twice so that I can perhaps understand it a little bit better, a little more deeply, consider things that me and what have you. And so these special editions are designed to do that. And today we're going to be talking about, well, we're going to be honoring Memorial Day. Just occurred. This is Memorial Day 2019. So that just occurred on Monday. And I thought that I would do a special edition in those who have fallen in service to our country. And so it occurred to me that, okay, well, I've been doing some reading and some investigation of aviation history. I'm kind of a buff anyway. I enjoy history. Aviation history is particularly important and meaningful in my life. And so, you know, I thought we would do a special edition on the history of air combat as a important aspect of aviation history. And I guess we'll begin, well, you know, got me thinking about this is a recent event that happened a couple of weeks ago. This would be, oh, let's see, this would be the first week in May of 2019, a speaking engagement at a symposium that was being held in Dayton, Ohio. And it was sponsored by Wright State University. And, of course, Dayton, Ohio is the birthplace of aviation. It is also the location of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, as well as the Air Force Museum. Okay, so I was there for, let's see, about 5 days, and I was at this symposium and, you know, doing my thing. I had a session there that I presented material, aviation-related material. But we also had some after symposium. That was scheduled rather nicely by the symposium organizers, and they one of the events that they put together was this was on Saturday morning, and presumably most of us would be flying back home to our home airport Friday afternoon, Saturday afternoon, and so they put together this aviation tour to a number of important sites within confines of Dayton, Ohio, where the birthplace of aviation took place, visited Wright Brothers' house and their place of business, their bicycle shop. We also visited the places where they conducted their many of their events. We also visited a museum there that was it's actually a national museum. It was administered by the Park Service. This was and the museum had lots of memorabilia and a lot of really fascinating historical stuff in it related to the Wright brothers and others. Either were directly or indirectly associated with and responsible for the birth of powered flight. And one of the places that we went to is that this airport close by had a flying replica of the Wright Flyer Model B, as in Bravo. It wasn't the original Wright Flyer. It was a later version of it, a little bit more substantial than the original Flyer. I can't remember when it was built. It was, you know, 19 first flight, and so it was built sometime shortly after that. Probably, you know, maybe 5 years after that, they upgraded a lot of stuff, and so they had a flying replica. That they offered as a to the people visiting their location in their museum at the airport that housed this airplane, they were offering flights. And these are short flights. They only lasted about 5 minutes or less. So I signed up and I actually took a flight in the Wright Flyer Model B replica. So you're sitting in front of the airplane without any protection, and you have the engines and propeller behind you, and it was a biplane. The pitch control mechanism was which extended behind the airplane. So that was the big difference between the A and the B. The A had a pitch control device in front of the airplane, and this airplane device behind the airplane. And so I took a flight, and there was, of course, video recorded, and it was really kind of fascinating. And so I began to think about aviation, the history of aviation in kind of a meaningful way. And so I thought, for our purposes today, for Throttle Up, I thought we would talk about the history of air combat, an important part of aviation, as I said, and to honor those who served in this capacity of military service, in this capacity as commanders. And of course, I am one of those people, one of those aviators who served in that capacity. That's where I began my aviation career, as a naval aviator and combat pilot, and eventually became a Top Gun pilot. And I began to, teach others. I wound up teaching others to engage in the special type of aerial warfare that we call air combat. And so I thought, okay, well, let's talk about that. And there's a lot of really interesting things. Are increasing number of books that are being they're being published on this subject. The last one is entitled Top Gun by Dan. I think that has just recently been released. It's available anywhere, and I'm in the process of reading it. And I would recommend it. It's a good read. It's a very interesting story, kind of fascinating, really. These stories, I consider them to be really a fascinating and important part of American history. And so I would recommend that book for anyone who is interested in history and particularly interested in aviation history, and this aspect of aviation history. Okay. Let me quickly begin this discussion today, and I'm going to repeat myself a little bit as we introduce this special on air combat. That's because I've mentioned this before in some previous Throttle Up shows. The how did aviation begin, and how did to the realm of combat, all right? So it basically began, the Army, sometime before, shortly before World War I, the Army became interested in aviation, and continued even from that time all the way up to today, and it's going to be well into the future. But anyway, the Army was interested in aviation for various ancillary reasons. They thought perhaps it would help them be better observers of the battlefield. Also, they could fly messages between major battle organizations. Stuff like that. And so they actually bought 11 Wright B Flyers. It's the same airplane. I flew the replica of it. It was an exact replica, because that airplane was pretty flimsy. But anyway, they did. And they subsequently bought a number of other airplanes of vintage, and they began to use these airplanes in World War I. And they quickly discovered that the airplane could not only perform well as a reconnaissance form or as an observer. They had been using balloons for observational purposes prior to this, and then they they substituted or they added in a substitute. They actually added the airplane as an observer, but quickly they found that the airplane could also drop bombs explosive devices, small explosive devices. But nevertheless, the airplane quickly became part of the combat forces. And also, the airplane was also outfitted with machine guns. And that took some doing because they had to be able to shoot through the propeller, but they figured that out. And if you want to know exactly how they figured it out, I would recommend that you go to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. They have an annex near Dulles International Airport, and they have a number of these airplanes on display, and they can explain how they discovered how to shoot through the propeller without shooting out and safely. And so the airplane outfitted with machine guns, then it became an aerial platform, and air combat began in World War I. You've heard of the Red Baron, heard stories about that, and flying at the seat of your pants, flying with scarves in the wind. These are open machines, the white scarves flying and all of that stuff. That began in World War I. And so that's the birth of air combat, right? And so we'll quickly move to World War II and what happened there. Well, the airplane during World War I and subsequently was quickly modified because of some of the shortcomings of the earlier designs, and that all proved to be quite effective. And so we quickly moved to World War II, and what happened? Well, there's two major things that occurred. The first thing is that World War II introduced the large heavy bomber. A heavy bomber at that time was a four-engine airplane. The first heavy bomber that was introduced and flown was the B-17. That was built by Boeing, and that was the world's first heavy bomber. And that was followed very quickly by A-4s, the Lancaster bomber, which was built by the British and flown by the British, I think exclusively. I don't know if there were any American pilots flying the Lancaster. I know that there were Canadian pilots flying the Lancaster. But the Royal Air Force Museum in right outside of London has a great exhibit of the Lancaster, as well as a whole bunch of other airplanes. And I've been there. I took one of my boys there about 5 years ago, I think it was, and we visited the Royal Air Force. They have a number of places. This one happened to be right outside of London, so you could get to it by train pretty easily. And so the Lancaster bomber was one of them. B-29 was the cream of the crop. It was a large four-engine bomber. I believe it was pressurized as well, and it could carry an enormous load of bombs as well as fast. And it was pretty well put together. It's fairly reliable. It solved some of the reliability problems that had existed previously. All right, so we have the heavy bombers. And then along with that, because the bombers had to be protected against enemy fighters, that became pretty clear in the air combat arena over Europe during World War II. So How did they do that? Well, they initially tried to do it with other with some airplanes that they had available. It was never really terribly successful. The attrition rate of the bombers coming out of France and England and bombing Germany was extraordinarily high. And they were running into some very serious problems because they were running out of crews and they were running out of airplanes because of so many airplanes were being shot down by German enemy fighters. And the turning point was the introduction of the P-51. P-51 Mustang was built in this country by North American aviation. But as it turns out, it was ultimately powered by a British engine manufactured by Rolls-Royce. So it was a Rolls-Royce engine ultimately. And the history of the P-51 and its development is really fascinating. I would recommend anybody that's interested in aviation read the history of the P-51. And then go visit the Royal Air Force Museum just north of London. They have one on display there. Great display of a P-51. It sits in the very center of the museum. And, of course, that was responsible for a quick end to World War II in Europe, the P-51. Almost entirely the result of introducing the P-51 in the air campaign. And it was a remarkable airplane, still is. It still is being flown by demonstration teams and individuals. Very, very popular, very remarkable. It was the first airplane to employ laminar flow and a bunch of other firsts. It was very fast. Top speed was 440 knots, and it could get up to 40,000 feet, about 40,000 feet, which really remarkably high for a piston-driven airplane. Pretty incredible. And so in World War II, the P-51 was pretty much the salvation, and it pretty much demonstrated a role that fighter aircraft will play in the world of air combat. And so that brings us to that particular portion of history. And we are going to discuss a few, well, I guess we could call them movers and shakers. Or the Mavericks or the people that were out in the forefront of advancements and contributed significantly to the area of warfare that we call air combat, or another term that is sometimes used as aerial combat. It basically means the same thing. Air combat, aerial combat, and fighter aircraft, and fighter pilots, and Top Gun pilots. They're all pretty much means the same thing. All right, so we're going to take a quick break, and then right into a few of, I've got four movers and shakers, or four what we call Mavericks. These are not the only ones, by the way. There is many. And I don't mean to slight them, but I've got four listed on my list of what I consider to be the top performers that really have contributed to the improvement and the dramatic improvement, by the way, of aerial combat. The first one is Brigadier General Robin Olds, United States Air Force. He started flying the P-51 Mustang in World War II, and we're going to be talking about him very briefly after the break. The second one is Colonel John Boyd. You know, I've talked about Colonel John quite a bit. He is one of the leading figures, not only in aerial combat, but also he is the father of maneuver warfare theory. Quite a remarkable gentleman. He's also a colonel. The third one is Captain Dan Peterson, U.S. Navy, retired, and he is the father of Top Gun. And the fourth one is Captain Smith, U.S. Navy, retired, and he is also one of the first people to get into the Top Gun Initiative. Actually, he and Dan did the Top Gun Initiative that was begun by the Navy, as it turns out. The Air Force eventually did come on board and promote the Top Gun program, but it was a leader. The Navy started this whole thing, and so Captain Peterson and Captain Smith, there's no relation, by the way, between me and Monroe Smith. We actually did know each other quite well. He and I served in at the Naval Air Station Miramar at about the same time. We did that I am aware of, but we do share the same last name. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back, and we'll be talking about Brigadier Robin Olds, quite a remarkable individual. Welcome back to Throttle Up. We're going to be talking a little bit about Brigadier General Robin Olds, U.S. Air Force. And as it relates to this whole history of air combat. But let me start off by talking a little bit about my personal experience in this arena. And the year was 1975 when this story begins. Okay. Now, as we all know, the Vietnam War was over. It came to an unglorious end at about that about in 1972, actually, as far as the air campaign was concerned. And during this time, it was time in the history of naval aviation to rebuild and repair our forces, learn important lessons, and adopt innovative operational concepts that we learned along the way, particularly in Vietnam. And these operational concepts, we were hopefully that there would be a force multiplier. Now, one such initiative that that was taken was, I think, what we call maneuver warfare. And this is where a relative force, highly agile, could defeat a much larger, less agile force. Maneuverability as a concept. Now, we have talked about this before when we were talking about Colonel John Boyd, and we're going to get to that in just a moment. So I just wanted to give you a heads up. Maneuverability as a concept includes considerations of agility and adaptability, both meaning that a particular force should be empowered to quickly adapt to changing operational conditions, as well as being in the movement of forces, that is, its movements. Now, with the distractions of Vietnam over, the Cold War was again in full swing, and it was time for us to seriously upgrade our fighting capabilities. For example, the Reserve Air Arm, which we call the Naval Air Reserve Force, was completely reorganized in 1972. It was flying for the first time modern fighting and support aircraft. The Pacific Fleet was being reorganized and upgraded as well. Constellation had just completed a major 18-month overhaul and was joining the Pacific Fleet as its newest aircraft carrier in 19. New aircraft, such as the F-14, was entering fleet service while others were being upgraded. New tactics were being employed, which included those by Top Gun, the Air Force Red Flag Initiative, as well as blue water operations for the carrier forces of the U.S. Navy, low-level penetration efforts, and large strike packages optimized to dominate the airspace above the battlefield. Now, enter the of what we call, or what I call, the Mavericks or the movers and the shakers or the thought leaders. And there were a number of them. And there, I'm just going to, like I said, I'm going to list, talk about four of them, this show and other shows. But there's a bunch more too. But I have picked out four movers and shakers for that were directly involved in improving and upgrading combat capabilities of our aerial combat forces. The first one, as I mentioned, is Brigadier General Robin Olds. And he was, originally, he was a fighter pilot in World War II. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that as we move forward in our discussion. This particular individual, quite remarkable. And now, as we enter this story, we're going to enter his story not at the beginning, but when he was a fighter pilot in World War II, and he's flying the P-50. And we mentioned that a few minutes ago. The P-51 Mustang was a game changer in the air warfare or in basically in warfare in Europe. And the reason for that, as we mentioned, is it had aerodynamic improvements and capabilities that were second to none. It had engine capabilities that were second to none. Pilots, again, flying these airplanes were second to none. And so they were the best of the best, and they succeeded quite well, really quite extraordinarily well in all phases of combat once this airplane was introduced. So we're going to enter this story about Brigadier General Robin Olds. When he was the officer or the commander, as the Air Force typically calls him, the commander of the 479th Fighter Group, they converted to P-51s in mid-September 1944. And his final, here's a discussion of his final World War II aerial kill. Robin Olds, and this occurred in April 7th, 1945. And he was leading the 479th Fighter Group on a mission escorting B-24 bombers mission dump in Germany. The engagement marked the only combat appearance of a German Air Force squadron formed to ram Allied bombers. Shortly, contrails popping up above a dark bank of cirrus clouds of aircraft flying above and to the left of the bombers. For 5 minutes, these bogies paralleled the bomber stream while the 479th Hill. Turning to investigate, Olds saw pairs of ME-262s turn towards and dive on the Liberators. After damaging one of the jets in a chase meant to lure the fighter escort away from the Mustangs returned to the bomber stream. Robin Olds observed a BF-109 attack the bombers and shoot down a B-24. Colonel Olds Major Olds at that time pursued the BF-109 through the formation and shot it down. Okay, so that began a rather interesting career in the life and times of Robin Olds. Now, let's fast forward to Vietnam. Eventually, he's a colonel at this time. He finds himself taking command of the 8th Tactical Fighter Wing, and that was based in Thailand. Now, it's here that a lack of aggressiveness and sense of purpose in the wing had led to the change of command. This was Old's predecessor. A short time after taking command, came up with this idea. It's kind of a fascinating story in itself. After suggesting the idea, was to plan that was intended to mimic the F-105 Thunder Chief, but to use in its place the F-4 Phantom II, which was air combat airplane with respect to what we call air-to-air combat. And it was much better. And so they reasoned that mimicking the flight path and other aspects of the F-105, the enemy forces, the MiG-21s, the North Vietnamese Air Force was flying the MiG-21s, which happened to be a fairly modern airplane, and they were wreaking havoc on the F-105s. And so the F-4 crews started this operation here called Operation Bolo. And they entered the air combat arena, and they were able to shoot down 7 enemy MiG-21s, which at that time was almost half of what was then the total number of airplanes that the intelligence community thought they had was 16. Half. And Robin Olds shot down 1 of the 7, of which he was awarded the Silver Star. Okay, so the reason why they were successful is Robin Olds began to consider air-to-air combat in a more serious way and was trying to all of his flight crews to be able to engage adequately and effectively in the air combat domain and become successful in such. And so he was one of the first to consider air-to-air combat, or what we call dogfighting, to be front and center of everything that we ought to be doing of air warfare. And so he brought that to the surface. Now, about the same time, Colonel John Boyd from the Air Force was making similar progress and was thinking along the same lines. Pretty remarkable achievement, but he was. And so let me talk about Colonel John Boyd and some of his accomplishments. Now, Colonel John Boyd began his flying career in, and he was a fighter pilot, young fighter pilot flying the F-86s. But he is famous for a number of things. One of them, not least of which, is the OO loop. That is a decision-making process That's quite remarkable, and many people have picked up on this. So we'll talk a little bit about it because this is a major contribution not only to air combat, but also to thinking in general. I would say that it is a major component of critical thinking, and it is a major component of being or maintaining success, becoming successful in any kind of complex endeavor where there are competitive forces afoot that are trying to outdo you in the marketplace. It could be on the battlefield, doesn't matter. These forces are trying to outdo you, and you're trying to remain successful and avoid them, or to defeat them, or utilize them in some way. I'm going to read part of this, rather fascinating. This brief article starts out by saying that Colonel John Boyd's key concept was that of the decision cycle, or what he called the OODA loop, the process by which an entity, either an individual or an organization, reacts to it. According to this idea, the key to victory is to be able to create situations wherein one can make appropriate decisions more quickly than one's own. The construct was originally a theory of achieving success in air-to-air combat, developed out of Boyd's energy maneuverability theory and his observations on air between MiG-15s and North American F-86 Sabres in Korea. The chief designer of the F-16 said of the OODA theory, time is the dominant parameter. The pilot who goes through the OODA cycle in the shortest time prevails because his opponent is caught responding to situations that have already changed. John Boyd hypothesized that all intelligent organisms and organizations undergo a continuous cycle of interaction with their environment. Boyd breaks this cycle down into four interrelated and overlapping processes through which one cycles continuously. The first component of the cycle is observation. And this is where we collect data or information by means of the senses. Signal is another term that is sometimes used. The second part of the cycle is orientation. And John Boyd, of course, thinks that this is the most important. It's also the most neglected. So that's kind of a conundrum. While this is the most important part of the decision cycle, it's also the most neglected. Okay, so orientation. This is the analysis and synthesis of data to form mental perspective. So orientation is, in fact, creating a frame of reference, or it is defining your particular mind space, what occupies your mind space. The third item of the loop is the decision, is the determination of a course of action based on one's current mental perspective. And I should also add here some kind of a projection with respect to what is likely to happen sometime in the near future. And the fourth item, of course, is action, which is the physical playing out of decisions. Once the decision, then, of course, we act upon it. This article goes on to say, of course, while this is taking place, the situation may be changing. It is sometimes necessary to cancel a planned action in order to meet the changes. This decision cycle thus known as the OODA loop. Boyd emphasized that this decision cycle is the central mechanism enabling adaptation and is therefore critical to survival. All right, let me repeat that. This is the central mechanism enabling adaptation and is therefore critical to survival. Boyd theorized that large organizations such as corporations, governments, or militaries possessed a hierarchy of OODA loops at a tactical, grand tactical, and strategic levels. In addition, he stated that the most effective organizations have a decentralized chain of command that utilizes objective-driven orders or directive control rather than method-driven orders in order to use the mental capacity and creative abilities of individual commanders at each level. In 2003, this power to the edge concept took the form of the DOD publication, Power to the Edge, Command Control in the Information Age by David Alberts and Richard Hayes. Boyd that such a structure creates a flexible, organic whole that is quicker to adapt to rapidly changing situations. He noted that such highly decentralized organizations would necessitate a high degree of mutual trust and a common outlook that came from prior shared experiences. Headquarters needs to know that the troops are perfectly capable of forming a good plan for taking a specific objective, and the troops need to know that headquarters does not direct them to achieve certain objectives without good reason. Fast forward to another initiative that John Boyd took part in, which was the aerial attack study. Now here, Boyd also served to recognize air-to-air combat in that he was the author of the aerial attack study. The aerial attack study became the official tactics manual for fighter aircraft. And Boyd changed the way pilots thought. Prior to his tactics manuals, pilots thought that air-to-air combat was far too complex ever to be fully understood. With the release of Boyd's attack study, pilots realized that the high-stakes death dance of aerial combat was solved. Boyd said that a pilot going into aerial combat must know two things, the position of the enemy and the velocity of the enemy. Given the velocity of an enemy, a pilot is able to decide what the enemy is capable of doing. When a pilot knows what maneuvers the enemy can perform, decide how to counter any of the pilot's actions. The aerial attack study contained everything a fighter pilot needed to know. The overwhelming belief force at that time was that air-to-air combat was a thing of the past. Boyd proved that this was very much alive. The Air Force was moving away from aerial combat because of development in. Boyd proved in his aerial attack study that the art of the dogfight was not dead by showing that fighter pilots could outmaneuver missiles. John Boyd's aerial attack study was revolutionary. It was the first instance in history in which tactics were reduced to an objective state. Boyd's manual proved that he was the undisputed master of aerial combat. Within a decade, the aerial attack study became the text for air forces around the world. Okay, so that is Boyd, Colonel John Boyd, U.S. Air Force, and his rather remarkable contributions to the area of air warfare. And we are quickly coming to the end of another show. So I guess I should conclude this with some concluding remarks and discuss future plans. So the history of air combat is the title of this special edition, and we covered two of what I consider to be four of the mavericks, the movers and shakers, the thought leaders, the people who took this into new dimensions or to relearn past things and to correct some of the mistakes that we have made along the way. Particularly in Vietnam, we made a lot of mistakes. We were under the assumption that many things that we had put in place with respect to modern weapon systems didn't actually work as advertised. And so we are continually learning from that, or putting things in place that were lessons learned, or we're emphasizing or re-emphasizing all the lessons learned that we have that have occurred during Vietnam, as well as Korea and too, particularly the end of World War II. We learned a lot of lessons. So the third discussion whether we're going to have, as we probably will do a second edition, second two of this special edition, we'll be talking about Captain Dan Peterson, who is the originator of Top Gun. That's the Navy program for fighter weapons. Navy Fighter Weapons School was the, and still is, the official title of this initiative. And finally, Captain Monroe Smith, who was also involved in the initial Top Gun program. All right, so why are we talking about this? Well, the reason why we're talking about this is a part of the reason is, of course, this is Memorial Day, just again, just occurred. This past May of 2019, and we wanted to recognize and honor all of those warriors that participated in aerial combat, who were killed in the line of duty, and as well as those killed in action during actual warfare operations. Both of those are very, very significant, and they are, and we should recognize the contributions that these people made. Many of them did not survive this rather challenging and difficult of warfare. Extremely difficult to train to, very challenging environment. Of course, the accident rates have always been extraordinarily high for various reasons. Some of them are obvious and some of them are not so obvious. But nevertheless, these situations were such that many gave their lives in service to this great in advancing the art and science of air warfare. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. Before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here. And I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing the opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. With that, I would like to say goodbye. And we will see you all again next week.